Coming up, one of the things that all the books behind me have in common is they believe in only studying success. And I'm sure you've seen that in the books in your bookcase and in your Kindle. Well, today we're going to study both success and setback. That and so much more coming up. Stay tuned. First, three messages. Who's the lawyer that founders in the Mixergy audience trust? Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Have you seen what Chris Pritchard posted on my Facebook page? His new companies and corporation pages that Scott Edward Walker helped him get. Scott Edward Walker is the lawyer that publications like Forbes trust. Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, when my friend had to close her company's office but still wanted to give callers the impression that all her employees work well under one roof together, what service did she use? Grasshopper. With Grasshopper, everyone who works for you could have an extension. They can pick up calls on their extensions no matter where they are or what phones they use, and they can transfer calls to each other back and forth with ease. Get those features and tons more at grasshopper.com. Finally, when Dave Jackson and Dave Petrillo invented a product that keeps coffee at the perfect temperature, what platform did they use to create their online store? Shopify.com. Look at how beautiful their store looks. It's because it's built on Shopify. They did hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales. Shopify stores are designed to help you sell. Patrick Buckley invented an iPad case and used Shopify as his online store. Within months, he sold over $1 million in cases. Get your beautiful online store at Shopify.com. Here's a program. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, with an interview featuring an entrepreneur who was one of the first entrepreneurs that I ever interviewed. We're going to catch up with him. We're going to find out how he built his business. We're going to find out what happened after TechCrunch put his business in the Deadpool and what happened when he moved on to Zynga. The guest is Andrew Lee. He is the founder of Jam Legend, which used to let you play a rocking guitar game online for free. When they closed, the team was hired by Zynga. I invited him to return to Mixergy to talk about what happened, tell the story, and to tell us what he learned along the way. First of all, Andrew, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You know what? I was a little stalling there with the intro. I didn't read the intro as I wrote it. I started stalling because just saying the word Deadpool was painful to me, especially around you, a friend of mine. When you heard or when you read on TechCrunch that your company, your baby, was Deadpooled, what did you feel? What happened?
Well, I actually laughed because the reason why people don't know this, but we actually so the reason why TechCrunch Deadpooled us was because we sent out a blast email to all of our users telling them that Jam Legend would be no more. But that's because we actually were acquired by Zynga about a year ago. So as a result of that, it was kind of funny because at the time, when you're in the middle of an acquisition, you can't really talk about sort of the specifics of what's going on. And they were at that point wanting to control the press. So they're like, okay. And then the next thing that happened immediately after that was people were like, oh my God, like a day, literally 24 hours later, they're like, we've heard that actually Jam Legend has been acquired by Zynga. So, but it's one of those things where it's weird because earlier in the morning, you have some friends who email you, and then some of those friends say like, hey, you know, I heard about this really recently. I'm looking for like a great team. Go ahead and join me on my next great thing to like take a rock ship to the moon.
I see.
And then halfway through the day, people are like, oh wow, hey, congrats, man, that's super awesome. I can't, you know. So it's, you basically have a wide range of emotion that occurs.
But you did have to close down Jam Legend, right? Which means that the product at least itself was Deadpooled, right?
Well, so yeah, to the extent that it's no longer alive. Yeah. I mean, we had, you know, 2 million users there who were really interested in continuing to use like a Guitar Hero online game. You know, Zynga owns all the assets. They own all those things. And you know, that puts them in a great position if they ever want to execute on the music gaming market. But they have way bigger fish to go ahead and fry over there. It's a great company. They have a number of different things they want to work on.
Okay. All right. So what I want to understand is both the highs and the lows. I want to understand about the how you got this acquisition. I want to understand what happened after the acquisition. But I'm going to challenge you to do what we as entrepreneurs instinctively don't want to do, which is to go and talk about the frustrations, the setbacks, the vulnerabilities, the issues that we couldn't overcome.
Yeah.
So let's go back to where the idea came from. It was a basic idea, right? You wanted to take a product and move it online. Can you describe what that was?
Yeah. So Jam Legend essentially was you take Guitar Hero, you put it online. And the real key here was that we knew that everybody on their iTunes account and in general had all of their music on their computer. So the perspective was, hey, you know what? A lot of people are wanting to go and play like Viva La Vida by Coldplay. And they can't do that. They literally cannot do that with Guitar Hero or Rock Band. Is there a way that we can do that within the within the browser? And more importantly, can you plug in your Guitar Hero and Rock Band guitar? And we made that system. I mean, we literally made a technology that could take any song and put it online inside a game.
Okay.
So that was the initial concept.
And I could rock out with my keyboard, just my computer keyboard, and start playing guitar. I don't even need to buy a device.
Yeah, you could rock out with your computer keyboard, or you could plug in your guitar or Rock Band guitar. Yep.
Okay. All right. I should point two things out that people have noticed that I hate when I'm a listener and the host doesn't even acknowledge it. First, I choked there earlier. My drink just went down the wrong pipe or something as I was talking to you. I thankfully was able to hit mute midway through the cough.
I'm shocked as well. You were like, oh, I thought Andrew was in the Deadpool. Oh,
right.
Oh, no, he got acquired. I had no idea.
Right. It's like, what is that sound all of a sudden?
Action right there.
Again, and also I am a little bit close to the Deadpool, I feel, this week. I just got back from New York where I was down with a fever. The other thing is your camera seems to be going bigger and smaller, wider and thinner. It's just something that apparently happens with some cameras. I just accept it because it's not about the camera. It's about the story. All right. Everything acknowledged.
Trying to adjust for my weight, actually.
It's a smart camera. All right. You raised a little bit of money. Was the first round of money, did that come from Launchbox?
Yeah. So initially we came out of an incubator. It was Launchbox Digital, very similar to like Y Combinator. And a great group of investors there, Sean Green, Julius Janichowski, and John McKinley. Each of them have gone on to do different things nowadays. But great group of initial guys. And then afterwards we came out here to San Francisco, and you know, it was one of those things where you're out there and you're meeting some folks and you're just like, hey, you know, there are some people who will just gave you a check after giving a demo. And some of, well, it's really, really amazing people, very, very bright people. And we raised our round approximately about, $650,000. And that was our first angel round, actually. And then we've just been operating ever since, which was great.
What was the overall, how much did you raise through the life of the company?
Through the life of the company, we raised, it was pretty much at like basically $650,000. Yeah, $650,000, around $700,000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, during that time, if you think about it, late 2008, that was like a godsend.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where it was just really impossible to be able to go ahead and do anything else.
And one of the things you told me about back then was that your vision was to launch a simple product, which back then was kind of revolutionary. You know, the idea was instead of blow it up big, go big or go home, have every feature that anyone could imagine and dominate by beating the competition by having every feature before they could even think of it. You said, no, I want to focus on a few things. It's got to be free. It's got to be online. It's got to be just a few different things, and then we'll launch. And then that got you to 1 million users within how long?
1 million users was pretty fast, actually. We got to 1 million users. That was at the beginning of 2009, like mid-2009, essentially. That got us, we got to 1 million users in a little upwards of like probably 3 or 4 months.
I want to study, as I said, the success and failure of the story, the success and setback, I should say. How did you go to 1 million users so quickly before you could piggyback off of Facebook's traffic, before you can sneak in through Twitter backdoors? I don't know. What did you do?
Yeah. So the thing for us is we had a couple, three different strategies. The first one that we did was on a sort of topic level, right? The theme that our perspective was, can we make it both inherently viral, which was very important, and then more importantly was if we made it free and we also made it, could it be something that was like inherently social, right? And we didn't do any of this Facebook, Twitter integration or any of that stuff initially. What we did do though was three, I think, tactical things. The first one was we did a number of different hacks that I guess people have done, like, you know, later on, and we're not the first to be able to do this, but back in 2009, it felt like we were the only people doing it, was, you know, we actually created, we limited access, right? Everyone thought, you know, you shouldn't limit access. We're like, we limited access. And we said, like, look, we only have a 1,000 registrants, you know, and the truth is the server probably could have taken more, but we said, you know, we're only giving a certain number of invite codes out, but if you tweet about us, if you Facebook about us, you know, we'll go ahead and let you in. And we'll move you to the ahead of the line. In fact, now there's companies that build this now, which is fascinating. The next thing that we also did was we made sure that when we built in a system, we built in a system for experience points, which at the time, you know, we used a lot in some of the social games, which was just to use game dynamics, right? The more people that you invite, the more powerful your character becomes or your particular presence, and then you can move up within the leaderboards. And that was actually something that where we created sort of artificial scarcity. So in both instances, there's artificial scarcity, both one in terms of access getting in, and then two, being able to move up within the game itself. And then probably the last thing was, I mean, it's just inherently viral. I mean, we honestly didn't know how fast it would grow, but all of a sudden, you know, my co-founders and I, all of us were staying up nights, literally nights on end every single day. I remember Arjun and Ryan, my Arjun Law and Ryan Wilson, my two co-founders, were just literally like they would each have text messages that would wake them up, and literally didn't get any sleep for like 3 days.
Text messages whenever there was trouble with the server.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like because basically we had to spool a new instance each time. So yeah.
I see. What kind of power would a player who's just basically rocking out his MP3 collection need to have? What kind would he so covet that he would do whatever you guys needed to do to grow your business?
I mean, it, to be fair, I think that what we did was we rode a lot of different waves too. I mean, like we talked about this in our previous interview, which is essentially, you know, every great surfer needs a great wave. That's like the basic fundamental tenet of the Bay Area has always been that, right? Every great surfer needs a great wave. And you can't be a great surfer without a great wave. And the important part about that is that when we were thinking about those, all creating our product, we knew that Guitar Hero and Rock Band were huge. We knew that there were huge mavens, people who were very, very deep into those games. So our perspective was, how can we empower those guys? And how can we make the game both more core, harder for them, but also at the same time where they'd want to go ahead and invite their friends and be able to create a really great place for them to play. Okay.
I see. So you're tapping into the wave of enthusiasm that existed around the game of Guitar Hero. And I do remember going to people's houses and seeing that they'd have the guitars all set up, waiting for somebody to ask them if they could play. But you also mentioned earlier that you'd give players more power if they did things like share Jam Legend, your business, with their friends. What kind of power would you give them? I understand. I guess I didn't play the game deeply enough to experience the significance of power. So can you tell me what kind of power would a player have?
Yeah, eventually what we did was, if you had a number of users come to the website, what you could do is it increased your level of experience, and those experience points help you level up. The more level ups that you receive, then the more power-ups you could have. Right? This was later on. We actually developed power-ups within the game that you could use. Like, you could, like, you know, explode things. You could have different ways to move forward within the game too. Essentially, you know, it's the essential equation that happens with most games, which is that at Jam Legend, you could play by continuing to grind, or you could buy power-ups, or you could, as you grinded, you got more power-ups as well.
But I can play to my own music no matter what. It's just what level am I at depends on what kind of power I have.
Yeah, it's the meta level above. So think about it this way: if you want to be the number one person on Viva La Vida, right? If you want to be the number one person on Viva La Vida, there's the other guy who's doing pretty well. But if you buy a power up, or if you've been at the site for a pretty long time and you have your own power up, you're going to be able to go ahead and do fairly well with those guys. Right? Like, because you
meaning that if I miss a key where I don't play one of the keys in the game, I don't get the I don't lose a point.
You don't die. Yeah, there's a number of different things. We had some pretty cool effects where you could, like, it would explode. There's all these really, really cool effects that we did.
Okay. And that's basically the gameplay, that on the screen it says, hit this key to play this instrument at this time. If you do that, then you've got the point and you've advanced a little bit. And then hit this key to play that sound at this time. So it's about playing the right sound, hitting the right key to do it, and doing it at the same time, doing it at the right time.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
All right. So you used all of that. You got to 1 million people. How long did it take you to get to the second 1 million people?
The second 1 million, that was more steady growth. I think that we eventually reached that probably in September, October of that, I think that was around December of 2009, early 2010 then at that point. And with that point, we wanted to go and we hit those 2 million users. I have to look at our blog posts. It's been a while. But yeah, no, we got to those users and it was great when we got there. I mean, like, we'd celebrate every single time and we loved our users. They were great people.
How'd you celebrate the first 1 million?
The first 1 million, I think we went and ate Indian food. Okay. There's this place nearby that a lot of other startups go to. There's this place that's a combination of Irish pub and Indian curry place. And those two things put together must equal a celebration.
You know what? I've gone to those places. I love them. Everywhere from LA, where they have a place that does that, King's Head in Santa Monica, to Argentina, where there was a curry and an Irish pub combination. It just rocks. All right. So decent celebration. But it seems like then the second 1 million happened when, in 2009?
Yeah. In 2009 and around 2010. Yeah, basically.
Around 2010 is when the second 1 million came. But you had 20, you had, when you sold the company, you had, I guess that was
May 2011. Yeah.
Yeah. So then at some point, did it plateau?
So for us, yeah, it was essentially what happened was, I mean, this is where sort of the setbacks occurred, right? I mean, we did the initial, I mean, if you looked at it, like Paul Graham talks a little bit about this, where it's like, you can go ahead, there's the shark fin that happens when you get like some media spike, you drop back down and then you start moving. And then again, you actually start having real organic growth that you've been actually working pretty hard to go and get. Mm-hmm. And then it's been pretty hard because the thing is, there's a trough of sorrow here that occurs. And then when you're here, you're actually at this sort of plateau of sorrow, where what you really need to do is you want to go and get a hockey stick up into the right. And the truth is that I think there were three things that happened with Jam Legend. The first was that no matter how hard we were able to go and work, I think that the market just sort of tapped out. I mean, we hit a large number of people. And at the same time, while Rock Band and Guitar were duking it out, it literally saturated the market. I mean, if you remember during that period around 2009, 2010, it was a significant amount of investment by those two guys. And they were just working really, really hard nonstop to go and market out their products. The issue, I think, is that when it comes down to creating, when the market becomes saturated like that, you have to grow in some other fashion. And I think exogenously what was happening was people were moving away from consoles and they're also moving into social gaming to a certain extent. And those were two different separate demographics. There were like highly female here and highly male here. But there were larger sea changes that were happening. Either people were going more in depth or they were playing lighter games on things like the iPhone, for example.
I see. Okay. What else was going on? You're saying that there are a few things that were going on at the time.
Yeah. So another one though was that I think that for us, we realized also that, you know, a lot of people were playing very deeply, but then we also started doing analysis on different countries and we noticed that, you know, a significant number of our users were actually in other countries. And what that taught us though was a pretty big setback, which is that, hey, you know what? How do you then monetize a significant audience that's outside the United States? Now, to be fair, the United States was our like number two place, but the number one place was someplace in the Philippines. And great group of people, amazing, great English speakers, and really well connected. The issue is when a country like that has low GDP per capita, it's very difficult to go and monetize. So we had to think of very creative ways to figure out how to monetize on an international level. A lot of people think that, hey, you know, growth is a great idea. It is a great idea. I mean, it's a great way to go and validate and test a particular group. But more importantly, though, is that even if you just grow, that's not as important if you don't take into account the average revenue you might get per user. Right, growth is not important. Growth is not good if all of a sudden the people who are helping you grow are 5-year-old children. Right, if it's all 5-year-old children who have no way to go and get their parents to go ahead and either spend money or find some way toward a business model, you're just basically providing a free service. Right. The way I like to describe it is this: right, you know, websites out there are very similar to locations around in the real world. Think of Facebook. Facebook initially was probably like, think of a community park. A community park where you can all get together, see each other. People sometimes bring some photos. They share some photos. You can see someone else's photo. You make comments about those photos. And then Facebook thinks to themselves, well, you know, what we should do, there's all these people here. Let's build a mall. Let's build a big mall inside the community park. Turns out the biggest place in the mall that everyone goes to is actually the arcade, which turns out to be Zynga. The difference with Jam Legend, though, is that Zynga is an arcade inside a very well-established mall in a great suburb. For Jam Legend, we found ourselves building a great game, a great you know, sort of arcade area. But our arcade area, we find ourselves in a sort of not nearly as high-income area, right? It's not like the mall where everyone goes to spend money. It's really just that we happen to be in a place where most of the kids who come there, are frequent there, don't have a lot of cash on them. Which is
that
fine.
Why not? Is that because what we're finding is that the nice areas are all walled gardens, as we're calling them, like Facebook? And if you're just out on the internet, hang your own shingle with your own website, you're really, you know, out on your own and probably in a bad neighborhood where things like what happened to you are going to happen.
Well, the truth is this happened to a lot of other companies. Right?
Yep.
I mean, like if you look at any company that has had significantly rapid growth, you should look at their demographic breakdown between both low income, high income, and look at especially country breakdown, right? You had a large number of people when the world was talking about Rock You and Slide for a while, a lot of those guys were pulling in people from Turkey, right? And nothing wrong with the Turkish people. They're great people. The issue is that how do you figure out a way to monetize? And I think this is actually a very big problem for international business, right? This is one of those things where if you run an internet company, you're able to go ahead and determine that you're actually able to run an international company. You have to deal with questions of exchange rate. You have to deal with questions of GDP per capita. And I think the main problem is that when you think about companies like that, nobody actually thinks about how to build growth, right? Growth is good, but growth by itself is not always good if it's the wrong type of users, right? Because they both impact how your product develops and also how your product gets received. And I think that going back to the analogy, yeah, ours was not a walled garden, right? I wasn't completely a walled garden. And if there's one thing I would have done in the very beginning is I would have not wanted as much growth. I wanted to get product market fit at the very beginning with a certain group of users and actually walled it off so that it's only, for example, US users or a certain number of users. Because the way that I think we should think about it is that human beings naturally want to go to a place where they know there's high value. They want to go and consume products that they know have high value. So you don't want to go ahead and use the thing that all the other people are using all other people that you don't respect are using. You want to go use the thing that everyone you respect is using, right? Think of all those people who at the time, at the very beginning when Facebook first started, right? Facebook had a great strategy where they first started, instead of being an open network, they thought about this, like instead of being an open network, very similar to MySpace, they went to be a closed network. And having a closed network generated more value. And for us, I think that the way we thought about it was, you know, the way that the product came out was it turned out to fit a pretty good audience. The issue was that when you have countries like the Philippines, it's difficult to monetize them. So this is one setback. But the thing is, we figured a way to monetize them, which was great. But it also meant that, you know, you had to cut down growth usage, which isn't always so great if people care about.
How are you going to monetize? What was the original plan for monetization?
Yeah, so the original plan for monetization was pretty easy. It was like freemium. We basically have a premium service where you could play a certain number of songs that you own, and if you wanted to play more, there would be a storage service. Additionally to that, we were also going to be thinking about like, hey, is there another area we can sell power-ups or virtual goods? And that by itself was a great model. And then lastly, we would do advertising for all the free users. The issue was that when we thought about how to go and monetize, we found out that, hey, basically, if we couldn't monetize them via advertising, if they're in, take for example, the United States, we'd be fine giving them free advertising, right? Then we would, if we couldn't monetize them through advertising, then we'd monetize them through premium service. The issue was that then at that point was that if neither of those business models worked, then as a user, that user is just costing us money. And we should then probably block them off.
That's when, I think it was December 2010, you said, look, if you're from certain countries, we're going to ask you to buy a pro or pro plus membership, right?
That's correct.
Okay. We'll get to the response to that, but let's spend a little bit of time on the earlier days. So the original idea was you're gonna make money from advertising or virtual goods or power-ups, right? Those are the three areas. Do I have it right?
Or it was actually a premium service, advertising, or virtual goods.
Premium service meaning more music that you can have.
That's correct.
Okay. Premium. And then what was the first one that you launched of those three?
The, the first premium service that we launched, or the first virtual good?
First revenue generating leg of this three-legged stool.
First one that we ever did was we actually did the we did a little bit of we did both a little bit of advertising and we did a little bit of the premium service. So initially, it was actually we were developing in 2009. We were primarily working on our technology, the very, very big technology of can you take a song and immediately turn it into a game? We were so focused on that, and we put it out there, and it turned out like it worked out pretty well. People used it. People started using our premium service. They started converting, but they didn't convert nearly at the rate that we wanted them to. So then at that point, we were like, okay, well, let's start monetizing through advertising. And then we started going through a large number of different models and testing different models to see against our user base,
How
to
long did
see
it
where
take you to test a model?
Probably, it depends, right? My co-founders are, I think, superhuman. So sometimes it would just take like 2 days. Other times it would take a month. Other times it never took more than 3 months. I can definitely tell you
Do you have an
that.
example of something that you tested quickly that got outsized results,
Oh,
unexpectedly
easy.
large?
I mean, advertising was probably the easiest one, right? Like at the point where we knew that we
I'm
needed to go
sorry,
ahead and
we
start
lost connection for a second. What was that? What was the easiest?
advertising.
Advertising.
Advertising was easy. I mean, advertising for us was we had a big enough base and it was easy enough to go and just throw a banner on. And then if we use the Google Dart system or we use a number of different systems, we'd rotate through a number of different ad publishers and then compare their CPM rates against each other. And then we'd easily be able to determine which ones started performing well. It actually turned out to be a great way for us to go ahead and determine how to think about each of these geographies, right? The way that we did it was we took every single country, we lined them up in an Excel spreadsheet, and we figured out the CPM rate that we got in each of those countries. Then out of those countries, we then determined, okay, here's how much it costs for us per user in terms of our cost of goods sold. Now, in each of these countries, for any person who comes to the site, we assume a sort of average perspective. Well, if that's the case that it costs this much and we get this much of a CPM, is it then worth it to go and keep that particular country in there? So then we actually looked at it from that perspective and we said, okay, well, in that case, this country is more prone to actually using a premium service than to actually using advertising because the advertising infrastructure is not nearly as strong as if in a first in a developing country or developed country.
Developed.
And then for developed countries, we still had a premium service and we still had virtual goods. Everyone could buy virtual goods. But the issue is, the question was, okay, if you could then monetize these countries through just advertising, would you just stick with advertising? And sometimes we actually said to ourselves, you know what we do? We don't even care about advertising for these folks. We just want to upsell them the premium service because the advertising is really for game companies, right? Game companies would try to advertise against our game because it was lead gen for them. It fit in with their audience. And our perspective was like, hey, we want to keep them on our page. So we would sometimes shut off advertising for them.
I see.
Right? It's in a way, using both models to interact with each other was a great way to figure out how the curve exactly worked out. And in terms of how we would monetize. And it turned out really well. We made money, so.
What was the most profitable, or yeah, what was the most lucrative of these three different options?
Initially, it was advertising. And then our premium service started catching up once we started doing geographic restrictions. So initially, it was advertising. And then advertising didn't dip at all because basically what we did is we found a way to go and monetize the free people who we couldn't monetize through advertising. So we just like turned on the premium service and all those people sort of jumped up and started making more of the premium service.
When you said you have to be premium or nothing, that's when it shot up.
Well, we gave them we actually incentivized their retention by basically saying, hey, you can only play like one free song a day. And then that would sort of get them in and they would be like, oh, I want to play more, I want to play more, I want to play more.
So if
So
you want to play more, you have to pay.
that's right.
You also did Super Awards, run by a past Mixergy interviewee. How'd that go for you?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So we did Super Awards. Basically the alternative payment structure was pretty good. I mean, if you think about it, right, all it is the ability to go ahead and generate a lead for another service. So it worked out pretty well. It was just a good alternative payment structure, and that worked out pretty well for both for the premium service and for buying virtual goods as well. I mean, you fill a survey, you get some. We get paid because the other business gets the information that they need, and they're able to go and generate some lead gen. And then for us, then the user is happy because they get a bunch of free power-ups, or they also get some areas of the premium service.
Right. So the user does something like go sign up for Netflix or takes a survey, and in return, you get money, and the user gets, as you said, power up. I want to make sure that people understand what Super Awards does.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
I assume that everyone in the audience understands that. And actually, you did a good job of explaining it. But I thought, let's just absolutely be sure that everyone's following along with every part of this so that they can use it all completely. So were you generating more revenue from that than you were from cash directly from users? Was it super awards type revenue more, or was it cash from users?
It's a little difficult because the thing is, we actually stopped using, I think we tried doing like our own payment processor through like PayPal and such. But the truth is that, it was easier for through Super Rewards because they actually, had a significant number of, they were able to go and take a multiple number of, payment strategies, and we didn't want to deal with it. So we're just,
I see. So you they handled your credit card payments also.
Yep.
I see. Got it. Okay.
That's right.
All right. So I understand about where the revenue is coming from. Actually, no, I don't. Let's go a little bit deeper in it. What I'm finding in these interviews is you've heard this, this framework that you're either selling ice cream or aspirin. You're either selling somebody something fun that they get to do, or you're selling them something that relieves a big pain. And you're more likely to get revenue by selling aspirin than you are by selling ice cream.
I'm wondering
if in a game business like yours, there's any aspirin. Is there any pain that people experience in your site that when you tap into that and give them a solution to it that they're willing to pay for?
Yeah, I think the way that people think about it, though, is that if you think about it as an entertainment vehicle, the way that I would think about Jam Legend was to a certain extent, for people in developing countries, at least in like the Philippines, for example, we were like huge in the Philippines. We were like an Alexa 100 site there. So in a country like that, if we were to take away the power for them to go and play Jam Legend, they felt that it was something that was so part of their like formative lives and that they wouldn't want it to disappear. The issue is this, like this, right? You can either be at the beginning selling aspirin or ice cream, but if you sell enough ice cream and everyone eats it every single day, you take away ice cream, it's going to feel just as bad as taking aspirin, right?
I see, like, right.
I think that's how most people think about it in terms of the entertainment business. The people that you care about are those who you highly retain. So what you want to do is at the beginning, you make a lot of ice cream and you figure out, hey, this is the biggest audience for all my ice cream. These people are coming back for more ice cream. And then what we do is then we continue to keep on doing that. And then we determine, okay, well, in that case, if we're doing that, are they willing to go and pay if we were to take some parts of it away? Or giving, like, would they understand if they wanted ice cream? You want to habituate them to the ice cream itself.
I see. So it's either taking things away that allows you to charge or adding new things. And for taking things away, how do you know what's going to cause the most pain for people to live without? How are you able to figure that out and then know that's what we need to charge?
We actually looked at the way that we thought about it was very similar to a lot of other game companies, right? You think about the curve, where you have a curve that goes like this, and the curve essentially tells you that like there is a median usage, and then you have a bunch of hardcore people. Now, the question is, at what point within that curve do you want to go ahead and say, hey, this is where we're going to start charging in this area, because this is abnormal usage, and we know that these people will be able to go and pay because they've converted fairly well. These other people, we're going to incentivize their retention. So, or we're going to incentivize some other metric that we care a lot about, virality, retention, whatever it is. So in this part of the curve, our perspective was, okay, let's focus on this area. And if we focus on this area, what can we do that would make sense? If we were to grab it and we were to go ahead and say, hey, all these people play, on a more concrete example, let's say people play 10 songs on median, all right? But then more people play up to like 25, 50, 60 songs. Anybody who plays more than 10 up to 12, for example, 12 plus is when we start charging. We're like, hey, you played a lot. You might want to go and you should pay for our premium service, or we're going to show you some video roll ads, right? And people are like, oh, okay, I don't want to do that, right?
You're looking to do is say, what characterizes some people as super users and take that and charge for that, because the super users are getting the super advantage from the site. The super users are the ones who are more likely to stick around, more likely to feel pain if we take these features away. And
right.
you're saying also you don't have to take it away completely. You can make it harder to get by putting pre-rolls in there.
That's right. That's right. So that's one way. That's the freemium model. The other model is when we think about the virtual goods model, right? The virtual goods model is more very similar to what you have in a game curve, right? So the game curve is essentially, as you level up, it's really easy to start leveling up, and then it gets harder and harder and harder, and takes a huge amount of effort to move up one level, right, later on. the perspective with that is that since you have a game curve, the game design curve naturally lends itself to being able to go and sell things like power-ups or virtual goods, because someone has to either spend time in order to be able to progress through the game, or they have to go and spend money. Time and skill, or they have to be able to go and spend money. So then what you do is you give them the right types of virtual goods at the right instant so they can get to the next level. And that is where you create scarcity again.
And is that more about eliminating pain or giving them pleasure? What are you charging for at that point?
At that point, what you're really doing is it's kind of funny that you say that, right? Like most games, most people would say, like, is that pleasure or is that pain, right? I mean, like, I'm working so hard in order to be able to go and farm my gold, or I'm working so hard in order to be able to go ahead and mine my crafts all over the place, right? Or be able to try to go and mine everywhere. The question is, I think what that is it's flow, right? It's the ability, it's how much time and effort someone has to go and take to be able to get to where they need to. And most people want to find the shortcut. It's just natural. It's humanly, it's something that's inside us. It's a part of our human nature. We want to be able to go and do that.
You mentioned earlier that the game world was changing, that on the one hand, people were going into these super games that were on consoles, and on the other hand, we're seeing more and more people go into casual gaming, like farming on Facebook. Did you consider either switching your model towards a casual Facebook-like game or creating other products? What did you consider doing?
Yeah, so essentially what happened is, if we follow this chronologically, right, like Jam Legend grew, we started reaching this sort of interesting plateau, especially with the music gaming market getting saturated. Our perspective was, hey, you know what? We noticed that there were a lot of guys on Facebook that were actually doing okay too. And we're like, okay, well, these guys are doing pretty well on Facebook. What's going on with them? So what we did was we actually made a game called Super Jam on Facebook, actually. And we made it completely different. We created a whole new system. It worked out fairly well in terms of us being able to create games. And fundamentally, what we did was, when creating those games, we found out that, hey, we could basically take the fundamental Jam Legend structure and be able to create like an avatar on top of it, put in more virtual goods, make the songs much, much, much more shorter. And it actually turned out okay. It was very similar to another game called Music Pets that one of our good friends over at Conduit Labs made. Nabil now he's a partner over at Spark, but he was over at Zynga for a while too. You know, what we found was, that pivot into that platform was a completely different platform than what you found in the open web. We didn't get nearly as much growth on that, though. I think it was primarily because Facebook at that time started clamping down a lot of the viral channels because they started seeing what Farmville had done, or like what Zynga and a number of other companies had done to use the platform. So their perspective was essentially, hey, you know, is there a way that we could... for them, they had already gotten a significant number of users. For us, it was more difficult. So we sort of had, it's one of those things where you think about more, much like great comedy, we just sort of missed the timing on that boat.
Yeah, there was a time there where you could just slam people with games and then slam their feeds and so on, and then Facebook clamped down on it. What about mobile?
So we were significantly thinking about mobile. We'd actually worked with people don't know this, but Adobe had reached out to us before back in the day when TapTap Revenge was pretty big. Adobe had reached out to us and they said, like, hey, why don't you help create an Android version? We tried to do it within Flash on the Droid device, the Verizon Droid device, and it just was not the experience that we wanted it to be. So we never actually did an experiment within mobile. That's something that we you know, my co-founders and I sort of talked about this after the acquisition. We're like, well, you know, it's something that we sort of regret in that we wish that we would have gone to mobile. But at the same time, we still don't think that music gaming would have had legs in the mobile gaming space. Social gaming, on the other hand, would have, or just any types of games. But music is a tougher nut to go and crack.
Were you considering why, actually? Why do you think music was tougher on mobile?
Yeah, the thing is, if you think about music gaming in general, music gaming is one of those things where you have a lot of issues with the market, right? Most of the time, it's already hard enough to build a startup. It's already way, way hard enough to go and build a startup. Trying to build a startup, there are a lot of things that will kill you. But in addition to that is the music licensing problems. I mean, we remember days when the music license guys were, you know, we would get something from Warner Music, and they would say, like, hey, you could use this song. Then all of a sudden, we put it up, And all of a sudden, EMI calls us and says, like, you can't use this song. But we're like, wait, but Warner Music just told us you could use this song. And they're like, no, but we own the publishing rights to that. We're like, wait, but didn't you guys ever talk about this stuff? And they're like, no, we don't. So then you kind of get them together and they sort of try to talk about it.
Oh, wow.
Fundamentally, though, I mean, beyond the licensing problems, though, are that if you think about the market itself, competition in a way is actually a good thing from the perspective of being able to have many types of experiments happening within the market, right? The reason why the Facebook platform started evolving so well was because you could get so many users, you could immediately monetize very quickly, and there was enough players out there who were trying to experiment all over the place where they would essentially copy each other and try to see what the other person was doing and sort of do another experiment on top of it. That type of market is a great market to be in because then you can really get a good sense as to where eventually everything's going to evolve. The issue is that trying to figure out where everything is able to evolve when it's only a market of, say, two or three people in the sort of music gaming online space, that's really hard. That's just way too difficult because you don't have enough experiments. I still personally believe that at some point there will be a great music game that will happen on the device, and there will be great ways that people will interact with music that we don't even fathom right now, right? It could be as a soundtrack to a game. It could be a number, or it could be like made very similar to any of those Zynga-style games. But the truth is that fundamentally what's happening is that, it's just too hard. I think that you need more players in a space. Not having competition is maybe not a good thing.
Why'd you stick with music then?
I mean, that was our goal, right? I mean, it's kind of like this. If our hypothesis is we think that we want to bring music gaming online, that's a hypothesis. That's what our investors invested in. That's what we believed in. We wanted to move forward enough. For us, the perspective was we could have pivoted, and we definitely did pivot a number of different ways. But the perspective was the thesis has always been music gaming online. And was there a thesis that we could draw and follow and figure out whether the hypothesis proved true or whether the data didn't support the hypothesis?
What was the best advice that you got from one of your advisors or investors?
Probably best piece of advice was, let's see here. We owe a huge amount of gratitude. If there's some great investors out there. I mean, in particular, just some great investors that were part of our round. I mean, there was Haroon Mukhtarzada, who's the CEO of Webs. He's just an amazing, amazing entrepreneur. He's out in the Maryland area. And then probably two of the other guys who were just amazing are the Partovi brothers, Hadi and Ali. I mean, I can't beyond compare. I think those, they are some of the best investors that you could possibly ever have.
Why?
And some of the reason why is because those guys, not only the thing about the Bay Area is that these guys have been through it, right? The perspective of having gone through of being acquired, having gone through a lot of the ups and downs of having to pivot, trying to move into different platforms, these guys are like the top of the line sort of investors that you could have out there. I mean, the Partovi brothers by themselves are already doing great work with both Dropbox, what they previously done at iLike, and with TellMe.
Give an example of something that they either told you or a piece of advice that Haroon from webs.com gave you.
Yeah. So Haroon, the great thing about Haroon was that he's, as an entrepreneur, he always was able to go ahead and like understand what we were kind of going through.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he would do it was he would always say things. He'd be a coach, right? So we had one of these ideas where we said, hey, we should charge for storage, right? We should have people upload their songs. And then if you don't own the song, and someone asks you to come play it against you, then you should have to go buy the song. And he said, like, well, doesn't that like fundamentally like break the social loop, right? If I own the song, but you don't own the song, but I want you to play it, that makes, and then you have to pay for it in order to be able to do it, you know. And the way he did it was he didn't do it in a way that was like a great advisor is one who's a coach. So the way he said it was he sort of suggested it to us most of the time. And the truth was he was absolutely right about that. He was absolutely right about how we should be thinking about product. Another thing.
How? Well, let me see, because right now I'm only seeing your perspective that you're, say Jam Legend comes over to us and says, look, you guys now can play the same game, but if one of you owns it and the other doesn't, you have to, the one who doesn't has to pay for it. So if I say to you, Andrew, let's play, I don't know, Stairway to Heaven. I have Stairway to Heaven. I play it. You go, dude, you jerk. Now I have to buy it? Forget it. I'm not playing this. Wouldn't you be upset? So how do you make it so that it doesn't come across as a jerky move? It sounds like he helped you find a way to present it properly.
Right. It was basically being able to put it on Amazon or find a way to go ahead and be able to play. There was a number of different ways that we thought about it. But I think fundamentally, the way that when Haroon was thinking about it, he just His piece of advice was that when we fundamentally think about the product, we should think about what it means in a social context, and more importantly, it should, he always had very great tactical advice. When he thought about how to think about the product or how to figure out that solution, he just basically said, the way you should think about it is, how do you make it so that no one feels like their social relationship is a burden, right? Like, if all of a sudden I want to play Stairway to Heaven with you, it shouldn't feel like, oh man, this guy just wants to make me spend money and not have me enjoy my time, right? And then we had to think about that problem. It's that type of coaching that I think is fairly important. Okay. In terms of the Partovi brothers, and with Ali and Hadi, I mean, it was both their whizzes at negotiation, but beyond that, they were able to go and see kind of where they thought the future would be in terms of the market. And their perspective was very similar to the extent that, hey, where could we go in terms of where could the music gaming market go? They were great in terms of really thinking about on a very high level where they thought the market of music was eventually going to go. And the issue is that I think it's still going to get there. The problem is the music industry just takes forever.
What's the best advice that you didn't take?
Best advice that I didn't take? probably that music is really hard. I mean, I don't do music. I like games, but I don't do music. Or some people were like, I don't do music or games. I feel that with the music gaming market, at some point, the perspective is that, a lot of people were absolutely correct in that, how could we know that there was a minimum viable product initially? And how could we know that we could monetize such product? We probably should have, at the very beginning, started charging much earlier, because then we would have known that our audience was not nearly as good as we thought it would be.
Charging earlier so that you know whether the audience is really valuable. That's one of the big takeaways that you got.
Yeah. Well, for us, it was actually just knowing what the audience was, right? It's difficult, because the thing is, growth is good. Growth is definitely a good thing. But the thing is, in an environment where all your growth is coming from, like, or a significant number of your growth is not coming from valuable areas or from users that you want, then you're going to have to deal with what that problem is, right?
Okay.
So, yeah.
Speaking of minimum viable product and the lean startup movement, you were one of the first entrepreneurs to talk about it and to say that you're building your business based on customer development philosophies. And now, before this interview started, you said some people get too hung up on it. I thought we should talk about that. How has your thought process changed, or how has the world gone way too far in the opposite direction to slavishly following?
So the issue is that it's essentially the Donald Rumsfeld problem, right? The Donald Rumsfeld problem is essentially there are no known, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. The problem is customer development and like the lean startup methodology only gets you the known knowns and potentially the known unknowns, right? But there's a huge amount of exogenous factors of luck that basically encapsulates your whole product. We had no idea, right? I mean, we had a pretty good sense that, you know, a lot of the validation already occurred because of Guitar Hero and Rock Band, right? We knew that it would work because of Guitar Hero and Rock Band. So being able to go and do that one step change function is totally fine. And I still believe that a lot of startups should do that, right? It's not really that you'll ever come up with anything out of thin air. You really just think of, how can I take a blah idea combined with another idea, and together that Hegelian dialectic equals a great synthesis. The issue I think now is that people are focused so much on doing like a survey, right? Or so much on doing like a landing page that they don't take enough risk. And they don't also understand that just because someone says, hey, I don't want to use, just because I don't want to go shopping already, right? I don't want to go ahead and sign up for like a subscription service for men's clothing. But the truth is that only until you've actually had the power to go and use that subscription service for men's clothing, you know, will you know that that's exactly correct, right? So for me, like I'm advising a company called Bombfell, and I love them. I'm actually wearing their, it's weird, I'm wearing their shirt.
Yeah,
right,
I was trying
now
to read what that shirt said. So it says Bombfell, okay?
Yeah, Bombfell, Bombfell. Everyone should sign up. It's really, really good. It's essentially like Columbia House meets men's clothing.
So they guys get, like, I get to buy clothes on the cheap, but I keep buying them on a regular basis from them.
Yeah, so it's just it's a monthly subscription service, and the best part is this. Here's the best part, Andrew. It's just that
hit me.
I don't like shopping at all. I really don't like shopping at all.
I can't stand it.
There's a buyer who used to work on you know in New York City. She actually selects the clothing for you that fits. She sends it to you. If you don't like it, send it back. Doesn't charge you a single thing. So it's the ability for someone else to basically shop for you, which is just amazing. And it's inexpensive too. Like you pay $70 and you get clothing that's worth $110. So you also benefit from economies of scale too. But anyway.
So you were starting to say that you advise them about the how to use Lean Startup without going too far. I'm going to Bombfell right now. It's slowing down your connection to me. There, now I've got the page loaded up.
That's totally fine.
I can't do two things at the same time on this internet connection. All right, sorry, go ahead.
So the question is, if you know, for guys like that, you know, they could run a survey and say like, hey, if someone had a personal shopping service for you, et cetera, would you use it? People would say, hey, you know what? I already shop already. You know, my girlfriend shops for me, et cetera, et cetera. But the truth is that what people should understand is that a company like this, where everybody, a large number of people in the Bay Area are using it because it's like they don't, it's essentially like the shopping service for them, right? They were only able to go and get to that point when they first started testing it and they started getting real customer interviews from real customers. The problem with customer development is you can get some known knowns and some known unknowns. But aside from that, you're not going to be able to get, you know, everything that you need. Sorry.
What was that?
So I think fundamentally, though, the question is,
First of all, what was that? Just since I want to call out all the random sounds so that people understand what's going on. That was just a cell phone.
It was a cell phone. My aunt was calling. Oh, via Google Voice, actually. So everything, when you use Google Voice, everything rings. So literally everything's
ringing. Oh, I see. So, but then sticking with Bombfell, couldn't you say to them, look, guys, you don't have to do anything more than just put up a quick WordPress site with a nice landing page saying that you will shop for people. Either you, the entrepreneur, if you've got a talent for it, will do the shopping and the advising at first, or you know, you get one person who's going to do it for you, and you test it to see if people are going to do a personal shopper with an individual. And then later on, you expand it into a bigger business based on the feedback that you get, based on the unknowns that you might discover through the simple test.
So you should definitely have like simple tests like that. The issue is that when you go up to an investor and those guys say, like, oh, too many buying sites, too many like personal shopping sites, too many Groupon deal sites, too many blah, blah, blah sites. Those guys don't understand, however, that I think fundamentally have the exogenous variables changed, have the variables around us changed in such a way. And the thing is, those are unknown unknowns, right? It's just like the Pinterest guys who said like, yeah, if I did any of this customer development, lean startup stuff at the very beginning, Pinterest probably wouldn't have happened at all. In fact, Pinterest would never have occurred. Because you know, nobody started using our site. And it was the same way with Jam Legend at the very beginning. The perspective of somehow there'd be early validation through traction is a lot more difficult. And I think fundamentally what people need to do is that the lean startup methodology works really well, but at the same time, you gotta have some guts. And you have to be it's a question of how much do you wanna go and invest in your product. You could continue to do small little heat tests, but until you actually take time to build the product, only then will it actually occur. Like it's the problem of surveys essentially too, right? It's the, you know, people will tell you that they want to buy something, but will they really buy it when you actually ask them, hey, will you actually pony up $10 to be able to do this? And we found vastly different results back on Jam Legend. Some people would say, I would definitely pay for something like this. And then we said, okay, we're going to do that. And then it turns out, hey, they don't want to pay for something like that.
But then wouldn't Eric Ries say that's not a good test then? That a survey is not a good test. It's not the perfect test to see whether people would pay. The better way to see if they would pay is to just charge them. I mean, before when he created the first event around lean startups, I think is around the time that he and I did the first interview here.
Yeah.
He said he didn't just do a survey to see if people would come to a lean startup event. He did a survey and then to people who said, yeah, I would pay, said, all right, now pay up. And I think he took only a small deposit from them, but in order to measure whether they really wanted to pay, he charged them.
Yeah.
So isn't that a better test? The surveys aren't.
I completely agree. But the issue becomes the whether exogenous variables change. There are some things that you can definitely know within a subset. But the issue is like when you're trying to determine whether your product compared to all the other products out there will become the next big product, and you're trying to look for the big wave that's occurring, it's hard to go and predict those things. And when all you're doing is working within the microcosm, you have no idea what else is happening all around you. And sometimes all you really need is, that's why I think for some entrepreneurs, there's this perspective like, I need to go and do all this lean startup stuff to figure out what's going on. But ultimately, it all starts down here. It all starts with, hey, I have this problem, or I'm going to have this thing that I want to work on within this market, and I'm just going to keep on working at it. And I'm going to work at it until, you know, luck actually occurs.
Help me understand that, because to me that sounds nuts. There's some people for whom it's going to work, but I don't want to wait for luck. I want to understand that what I'm doing does make sense. I want to make the first batch of cookies and take it out and see if anyone wants to buy, if anyone likes it. And if they do, will they buy my second batch? And then if they do that, then see if I could go and, you know, grow a little bit at a time. But I want to have people try it first and then build before I imagine what they're going to want me to build.
Yeah, so you're right, it's a combination of cleverness as well as luck, and that's what a lot of people will tell you. The issue is that, you know, Michael Lewis just talked about this at his recent graduation speech at Princeton, is the question of, well, sure, you are, a lot of people out there don't want to ascribe a lot of their success to luck, right? To a lot of people out there, they honestly believe that if it weren't for them, they would be the number one gaming company, the number one web company, the number one blog company. And it's actually the confluence of a large number of things, right? YouTube could not have existed without the wide adoption of broadband. Foursquare could not have existed without the wide adoption of smartphones. And a lot of these things you can go ahead and predict, but a lot of these things you can't predict in terms of how they would make sense. Like, I know not many people would have also been able to, like, some people would have known that photos would have been a pretty big deal, but no one would have been able to predict that actually photo filters, the number one thing that would like generate a huge amount of growth, right?
You know what? I hear what you're saying. I think a big part of this is that there are two things going on. First of all, Eric Ries has disappeared. His book has done well. He doesn't need to keep promoting his ideas anymore, and he's probably out working on his ideas with big companies. So we're not hearing his perspective on things. Secondly, when we did start hearing the Eric Ries lean startup ideas, there was no debate about it, because he did hit at a great time in the world for his ideas, at a time when seed funding was big, when small accelerators that were only putting in a few thousand bucks were big. And of course, those ideas and that kind of money, his ideas and that kind of money seemed like the perfect marriage. And people just took off with it without having the kind of debate that we often have in our world to see if to have him justify it and to have us really believe that it's true. So he got a quick pass back then. Today, when people are starting to say, hey, wait, there's some doubts, we're seeing some things that we're not sure about, it feels to me like he's not around to defend it. It feels to me like he's not here to say, guys, let me explain how I see it or how I've changed the way I see things.
Well, what do you think of that? About it is that he's right. I mean, here's the thing. If you're trying to build a short-term business that you can get immediate feedback and information from, lean startup, perfect, right? You have the information in front of you.
I'm not saying that it's just for short-term businesses. I'm just saying that it worked in a world where people didn't have much money to invest. They had only a little, so they needed a little, you know, philosophy that said start lean.
Right, which makes sense. And I'm still a big believer that, like, that small things come from lean products, that you don't need a huge amount of money. But fundamentally, another question is, for the big things that we want in the future, like for large robotics or any other industry, obviously the lean startup doesn't completely work out. The question for a lot of people is whether, okay, if we are going to fundamentally be making a great business for the future, we need to just choose a market. And we have no idea how that market is going to change exogenously, but there are some things where the lean startup methodology, doesn't take into account. There is a variable at the very end that consistently moves that we cannot predict. And sometimes it has more of an impact upon the success of your startup than you realize. And I think that's something in which, you know, that is something also is a very difficult thing to go and challenge, right? Yeah, of course there's unknown variables that we can never be able to take into account. I do, however, think that when you think so myopically at the very beginning of your startup, and when you're thinking about lean startup methodology, you should really be thinking much bigger, like thinking about painting the future and then thinking of, okay, what is the beachhead that I'm going to do within that area? And then that's going to allow me to go and build a much bigger company.
I'd love to do a debate with Eric Ries and someone who wants to take the other side or wants to not disagree with the Lean Startup movement, but to point out the things that they believe have changed and that his ideas don't take into account.
Choose any of the guys from Andreessen or from Founders Fund. I can tell you that those guys don't think that Lean Startup's a great thing. Because the thing is, like, for them, they want to have portfolio companies that are huge, like portfolio companies that are fundamentally going to change the way that we interact with technology and in the future. The Lean Startup methodology is great for both big and small, but the truth is that it's limiting to the extent that that's the first thing that people should start out with.
You know what?
Again, you have...
My internet connection is slowing again because I'm checking out your website right now, and what I see on your website is epiphany after watching Star Wars. I hope I don't lose everything here. Let me see if I do. You know what? I'm just going to kill it. Let me see. Did I lose you? Oh, there we go.
I'm still here.
All right. I had to close it out because my internet connection just stinks here. Thank you, Regis. You know, in a third world country, in Argentina, I had better internet access than here.
That happens.
This is Washington, D.C. Here's the thing. I've now known you for what? 3 years? 3 years, at least. Over 3 years.
Yeah.
I love your ideas, and I love the way that you think about you think in a very organized way about our space. I'd love to see you blogging more about this. I saw you on Hacker News the other day. People were acting like jackasses around the whole Meebo thing, and you came in with a personal story that brought reality back into the conversation there. I'd like to see you do more of that. Bring your personal stories and your personal analysis and really talk about what's going on in the space. Why don't you do that?
AndrewLee.com unfortunately is a blog that I should be blogging more at, so maybe I shouldn't have a blog if I don't blog at all.
No, you should have a blog even if you blog once a year. I'm just going to urge you to find a way to get these ideas out. Right now you're doing it through the Founder Institute one-on-one sessions. I think that's a great way to start, but I'd like to see you do it on a broader place where you can just discuss ideas without immediate practical application. Just discuss
right.
what you're seeing in the world, because I think there's a lot of value to it. And frankly, I was trying to bring it out of you in this interview, partially because I was sucked into this conversation because it became interesting to me, and partially because I just know that you've got it in you. And I'm not satisfied with the way that I did it. I really could have come up with better ways to draw you out on this, and it's just not my forte. Still, I think we got to get a good understanding of where you're seeing the lean startup movement can be improved or needs to be put aside for bigger risks.
Yeah. I think it's a great time right now to be an entrepreneur, though. I mean, like, besides the fact that there is this frothy sort of early stage bubble problem, but besides that, though, it's still a great time to be an entrepreneur. I mean, for a lot of people out there, I mean, I come from Asian parents, and all those Asian people who are listening out there, I mean, honestly, you got to tell your parents and your family about the question of acceptable risk.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any sense how so many people out there take risks for their families, and then they tell their children to never take risks at all, right? That seems like, you know, it's sort of like do what I say, but not what I do.
Asian parents who came into the U.S., took big risks on a new culture, new job, new life, new everything, and then they say to you, hey, you know what? You should get a job because you're smart, because we worked this hard to make sure that you could become an engineer who's going to do well.
Yeah, I mean, like, my family still tells me to this day, like, you should go to grad school. I was like, I go to grad school? What am I going to do with it? You know, I mean, like, it's one of those problems where I think that, you know, there is, well, to be fair, you know, I understand the value of grad school, but the problem is that the question of acceptable risk is something that our generation needs to understand. Like, supposedly, we're the hero generation. There's a lot of problems that are going to be happening beyond the fact that our federal government might potentially collapse from all of its debt or all of its programs or anything like that. It's a very big question as to, can we pave the world of the future? And I think the methodologies and things that we do, whether it's lean startup, whether it's incubators, whether it's being able to have the on-the-ground training that you have as a startup, that type of work is, you know, it's hard to find out there. Where you, and it's okay to go and have acceptable risk in one's life, because the truth is, it's a question of, you know, you can't de-risk yourself all the way. And even people who are buying up gold right now, I can tell you right now, you're going to have to de-risk yourself all the way.
See, you went to talk about education, about the next generation for immigrants, about risk-taking, about the hero generation, and then gold. All these things are perfect for blog posts, for deep examination. All right, let me tell people about they want to take this relationship, their relationship with Mixergy, to the next level, what they could do. And then I've got to come back down from the stratosphere, down to the ground, and ask you a question that no other site is probably going to ask you. Now, all the other sites, I think you go to Pando Daily. Sarah is terrific at getting the big ideas out of you. What I'm really good at is coming right back down to the dollars and cents and the on the ground problems and solutions. So let me quickly say, look, guys, if you like my questioning over here, and what you want is more of it, if you're saying, look, I want more practical, I want to know exactly how to let me give you an example. Let's suppose you like what I'm saying about this idea that you need to talk to customers before you sell to them to understand what to create and then put out a small first version for them to use and then to give you more feedback. And this whole process is interesting to you and you want to know how to apply practically. We got a course for that at mixergypremium.com. You go there. I keep talking about this over and over again because it's one of the best courses there. You see Cindy Alvarez talk about how she listened to customers express their frustration, their pain, and how from that they were able to create a product that's one of the best analytic packages on the internet. They're taking on Google and winning because of this process of listening to customers and developing for them. If you want to know about how to get the world to know about your product, we got Fee Fighters, who's fantastic at getting attention for themselves. They actually ended up selling the whole business. I got Fee Fighters to come on and talk about how they get publicity, step by step, walk you through how they identify the right reporters, the right outlets, how they court them, how they get them to write about them, and how they get all that publicity. Anyway, that topic and so many others is explained in detail at mixergypremium.com. Go over there, sign up, and start taking those courses. The sooner you sign up, the sooner you're going to see real results in your business. MixergyPremium.com. That's how I got to keep selling to make sure that I'm on the right track, that I'm selling to the right audience, Andrew Lee.
It makes sense. I mean, if I had Mixergy Premium at the very beginning, I probably wouldn't be talking about all the things that probably are in Mixergy Premium. all the different tactics that I already know. It's just like, oh, only have this package.
MixergyPremium.com. There's a great endorsement. Thank you. All right, here's what I want to know. How much did you sell the business for?
Oh, so that I actually can't tell you.
Are you personally a half millionaire as a result of that sale or more?
I'm sorry?
Were you able to put a half million or more in your pocket as a result of the sale?
I'm able to go ahead and be happy with where I am. But the truth is, I think the truth is, when it comes down to questions like that, I don't think that matters, right?
It's one Why of those doesn't things it matter? Where I'll tell you why it matters for me, because I want you to understand my cycle place. I judge myself based on revenue. I judge myself based on, I hate to say it, net worth, because it means that when I do interviews with certain people, I feel like I judge myself very poorly as a result. I've learned to get past that, but it's still a part of it. My sense of safety comes from knowing that, you know what? I don't have to worry about paying the rent here for Regis. And if Regis screws me over and I still have a contract with them, I could still pay them and, you know, go on to another place. Life feels good. I could take risks asking you questions because if everything falls apart, I'm not out on the streets. To me, money does give me security. Yep. But you don't need that. Why?
So the best way I like to describe it is this, right? If you money is important, right? If you're obsessed with money, though, that's unhealthy. Okay. And if you don't care about it at all, that's also unhealthy.
Okay.
My perspective is I was born in a very humble environment. Both my parents came from southern China. You know, even though my father was an entrepreneur, he started his own restaurant in Denver. And, you know, we did pretty well for ourselves. But the truth is that, like, I lived in a very strong, you know, tiger mom sort of household where I learned how to value the worth of a dollar. And my perspective has always been that, personally for me, as long as you have a roof over your head and you're able to go and do great things. I measure myself not by the amount of money that I make, but I measure myself by the change that I'm able to go and see in the world, right? Personally for me, it's a question of, okay, Jam Legend was able to go and be a formative experience for a significant number of people, for 2 million people. We were able to sell it to Zynga. Great. My investors got something out of it. We got something out of it. And it turned out well for everybody. You know, we all own Zynga stock, which is great. I mean, it's a great company. The thing now, though, for me is, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, it's more about the times that you have at bat. If you ask a baseball player, you ask them, how much do you care? You know, baseball players care about how much they earn. But really what they care about is they care about how well they perform also at the game. And they care about how many home runs they're able to go and hit, how many times they get on base, and how whether compared to the other baseball players out there, how well they do, because that's the thing that's more important. And what comes from that is money, right? That's a secondary part, right? It's I've always lived the philosophy, I think, that money is a way that you can keep score, but the truth is that it's really hard being an entrepreneur. So you better just love what you do, and you better be happy by what you do, and you better be in the flow of what you're doing. Because if you're only motivated by money, then you're not morally bankrupt. But the thing is, you're not being motivated by something completely different. The Economist did a story about this too, where they talk about great companies, right? Great companies aren't, if every company out there was just there to make money, they would just say, our motto is to make as much for your bottom line as possible. But it isn't, right? They have a thesis and a philosophy that says we network networks. We want to go and connect people in the world. We want to go ahead and provide the storage solution for all people, right? That's the type of thing that is so much more important. When you move into the realm beyond the realm of the bottom realm of Maslow's hierarchy, and you start moving up toward the world of values. And a lot of people get that at an earlier stage. Some people get it at a later stage. But all of us need to get it, because at the end of all things, in the long run, we're all dead.
And you know what? You're right. I think once I get a sense of security for money, the next thing I do look for is not more money. It's how do I have an impact on the world? How do I not be another guy who's watching everyone else live a great life, but live a great life myself too? It's those things. How do I end up in a relationship with someone who I care about, not someone who I tolerate? Everything else then just, I have more room for it.
Right. I think fundamentally you're right.
Was it an acquihire? Did your investors get more than the money that they put in the business back out of it?
So it depends, right? I mean, like, if you think about an acquihire, people think about it as are they getting it just for the team? Or are they getting it for the assets? It was a combination, right? They own all of our assets, and they also have our team. And we've been able to go ahead and justify a lot of where we ended up. I think the thing is, if you were to think of us as a strategic acquisition, we were definitely not that, right? A strategic acquisition in which, you know, we're like a draw something, where they're like, we need this product, it's doing really well, it's part of our portfolio. But I think that acquisitions like us still contribute very strongly to the Zynga bottom line. And I can tell you that it's still something that we think about a lot.
How do you contribute to the bottom line?
Well, in terms of our team as well, right?
I mean, and the work that the team does, it's going to impact the bottom line at Zynga.
Right.
Yeah. Did investors get back more money than they put into the business?
I have to look at that. I mean, depends on how Zynga stock does.
Okay. All right, what's your biggest takeaway from Jam Legend? Can we say that you're no longer with Zynga? We can, because
yeah,
I won't publish this until it's
over. Yeah, I'm just about to go and leave Zynga. Happy, I had a great time there, great people. But I think the thing with me is, worked on a great product. But the issue is, there's only a number of times at bat if you're an entrepreneur, and you have to be able to go ahead and take advantage of those. Because there's always going to be a Zynga 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that I can be able to go and work at.
You're an entrepreneur. You need to take a risk. I hear that, and I see it in you, and that's what you're going back to do. And I would also like to see you, in addition to this need that I have for you to blog more, to write more about your ideas, I think you'd be a great advisor, because you have strong opinions that are well articulated and also have good information behind them, that even if the entrepreneur you're advising doesn't end up taking your point of view, doesn't end up doing what you suggest to do, at least understanding how you came up with your point of view would be useful for them. And at least having that rationality in their head would allow them to either come back to it in the future when it makes more sense for them, or to shape their thought.
Yeah. I think first of all, I appreciate that. I do not have nearly as much experience as all the guys out there, but I think that my perspective is that for a lot of people out there, if I was an advisor, it's a question as to, my perspective is that some things you just learn through osmosis, and some things you just have to go and make your own mistakes. My hope is to be able to not have you make those mistakes, because it's costly.
All right. And actually, you know what? I don't know if you're an advisor or not. You are an advisor to Bombfell, but we reconnected with you through the Founder Institute.
Yep.
We realize, hey, you know what? We don't have to go and look for our own guests. If they're pockets with great entrepreneurs, potential guests, we should just partner up with them. And so we went to the Founder Institute. We asked them if they'd help us meet a bunch of their mentors. And yep. when we saw your name, we said, wait, we know him. We'll connect with him directly. But they helped remind me that I needed to have you back on. So
yeah.
if anyone wants to work with you, they can go to the Founder Institute where we connected with you.
Yeah.
And if they want to find out what you're up to, is andrewlee.com the best place or should they check Twitter?
Either one. Twitter is usually, I think, the place where somehow I feel that the noise inside my head needs to come out of my head and then thereby drowning out all signal altogether. But
so it's more fun.
But I would just simple email is fine. Andrew@andrewlee.com is totally okay. Right. I'd love to hear from people. I think the thing is, since I'm leaving Zynga, going to go traveling for a bit, going to be actually spending 7 weeks in Alaska out of all places.
Wow.
As well as in South America. But really going to be thinking about, you know, what is the next thing? Because if there's anything that anybody takes out of this conversation, you know, beyond the, if the first lesson that you hear is every great surfer needs a great wave, I think the second lesson is basically every surfer needs to just be out there and more importantly needs to just believe that there's a wave out there, but you just have to figure out what place you want to surf in.
All right, that's a great place to leave it. We're in South America. I actually have to do this too, because when I was on Leo Laporte's program and I was in Argentina, I mentioned that I was in Argentina. The guy who runs the Vines of Mendoza said, why don't you come out to our place? I ended up at the Vines of Mendoza, this beautiful vineyard in Mendoza, and enjoyed a great asado just because I happened to mention where I was going. I connected with a great guy. So where are you going to be going in South America?
Santiago, Chile. This is through the Founder Institute, so I'm going to be doing some mentorship through them. So Santiago, Chile, Bogota, Colombia, and Medellin, Colombia.
All right. Hopefully people in the audience will get to see in person.
And then otherwise, between middle of July until the end of August, if anybody wants to find me, I'll be in Sitka, Alaska, out of all places.
All right. Right on, Andrew. Thank you for doing this interview. Thank you all for watching.